The Horse Whisperer, Disc 11.
Chapter 34. The party was Frank's idea. He said he had it from the horse's mouth. Pilgrim had told him he wanted a party, so a party there would be. He phoned Hank, and Hank said he was up for it. What's more, he said he had a house full of bored cousins up from Helena, and they were up for it, too. By the time they'd called everyone they could think of, it had gone from being a small party to a mid-sized party to a big one, and Diane was having 50 fits, wondering how she was going to feed them all. "Hell, Diane," Frank said, "we can't let Annie and Grace drive 2,000 miles home with that old horse of theirs without giving them a good send-off." Diane shrugged, and Tom could see her thinking, "Why the hell not?" "And dancing," Frank said. "We gotta have dancing." "Dancing? Oh, come on." Frank asked Tom what he thought, and Tom said he thought dancing would be fine. So Frank called Hank again, and Hank said he'd bring his sound system over, and they could have the colored lights, too, if they wanted. He was there within the hour, and the men and the kids rigged it all up outside the barn, while Diane, shamed at last to better humor, drove Annie down to Great Falls to get the food. By 7, everything was ready, and they all went off to clean up and change. As he came out of the shower, Tom caught sight of the blue robe by the door and felt a dull lurching inside him. He thought the robe might still smell of her, but when he pressed it to his face, it smelled of nothing. He hadn't had a chance to be alone with Annie since Grace came back. The sight of her tears for Pilgrim had made him want to run to her and hold her. Not being able to touch her was almost more than he could bear. He dressed slowly and lingered in his room, listening to the cars arriving and the laughter and the music starting up. When he looked out, he saw there was already a crowd. It was a fine, clear evening. The lights were finding a glow in the fading light. Clouds of smoke drifted slowly from the barbecue where he should be helping Frank. He searched the faces and found her. She was talking with Hank. She was wearing a dress he hadn't seen before, dark blue and sleeveless. As he watched, she threw her head back and laughed at something Hank said. Tom thought how beautiful she was. He'd never felt less like laughing in his life. She saw him as soon as he stepped out onto the porch. Hank's wife was going in with a tray of glasses, and he held the screen door for her and laughed at something she said as she passed. Then he looked out and found her eyes at once and smiled. She realized that Hank had just asked her a question.
"Sorry, Hank, what was that?"
"I said I hear you're heading home."
"Yes, afraid so. Packing up tomorrow."
"Can't tempt you city gals to stay, huh?"
Annie laughed, a little too loudly, as she'd been doing all evening. She told herself again to calm down. Across the crowd, she saw Tom had been hijacked by Smokey, who wanted to introduce him to some friends.
"Geez, that food smells good," Hank said. "How about it, Annie? Should we get us some? You just come along with me."
She let herself be led, as if she had no will of her own. Hank got her a plate and piled it high with chunks of blackened meat, then flooded it with a dollop of chili beans. Annie felt sick, but kept on smiling. She'd already decided what to do. She would get Tom on his own, ask him to dance, if that's what it took, and tell him she was going to leave Robert. She would go back to New York next week and break the news, first to Robert, and then to Grace.
"Oh, God," Tom thought, "it's going to be like last time." The dancing had been going on for over half an hour, and every time he tried to get near her, either she got waylaid or he did. Just when he thought it was clear, he felt a tap on his shoulder. It was Diane.
"Don't sister-in-laws get to dance?"
"Diane, I thought you'd never ask."
"I knew you never would."
He took hold of her, and his heart sank a little when the new number turned out to be a slow one. She had on the new red dress she'd bought in L.A. and had tried painting her lips to match, but it didn't quite work. She smelled pungently of perfume with an undertow of booze that he could detect, too, in her eyes.
"You look terrific," he said.
Thank you, kind sir.
It had been a long time since he'd seen Diane drunk. He didn't know why, but it made him sad. She was pressing her hips into him and arching her back so much that if he were to let go of her, she'd topple over. She was giving him a kind of knowing, teasing look he neither understood nor much liked.
Smokey tells me you didn't go to Wyoming after all.
He did?
Uh-huh.
Well, that's right, I didn't. One of the guys down there got sick, so I'm going next week instead.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Diane, what is this? He knew, of course. And he chided himself for now giving her the chance to say it. He should have just closed the conversation.
I just hope you were a good boy, that's all.
Diane, come on, you've had too much to drink. It was a mistake. Her eyes flashed.
Have I? Don't think we haven't all noticed.
Noticed what? Another mistake.
You know what I'm talking about. You can get a smell of the steam rising off the pair of you.
He just shook his head and looked away as if she was crazy. But she saw it hit home because she grinned in victory and wagged a finger at him.
Good job she's going home, brother-in-law.
They didn't exchange another word for the rest of the number. And when it was over, she gave him that knowing look again and went off swinging her hips like a hooker. He was still recovering when Annie came up behind him at the barn.
Pity it's not raining, she whispered.
Come and dance with me, he said. And he took hold of her before anyone else could and steered her off. The music was quick, and they danced apart, only uncoupling their eyes when the intensity threatened to overwhelm or betray them. To have her so close and yet so inaccessible was like some exquisite form of torture. After the second number, Frank tried to take her away, but Tom made a joke of being the older brother and wouldn't yield. The next number was a slow ballad in which a woman sang about her lover on death row. At last they could get their hands on each other. The touch of her skin and the light press of her body through their clothes almost made him reel, and he had for a moment to close his eyes. Somewhere he knew Diane would be watching, but he didn't care. The dusty dance floor was crammed. Annie looked about her at the faces and said quietly,
"I need to talk to you. How can we get to talk?"
He felt like saying, "What is there to talk about? You're going. That's all there is to say." Instead, he said, "The exercise pool. In 20 minutes, I'll meet you." She only had time to nod because the next moment Frank came up again and took her away from him. Grace's head was spinning, and it wasn't just from the 2 glasses of punch she'd had. She had danced with almost everyone, Tom, Frank, Hank, Smokey, even dear sweet Joe. And the image she'd had of herself was thrilling. She could whirl, she could shimmy, she could even jive. She didn't once lose her balance. She could do anything. She wished Terry Carlson was here to see it. For the first time in her new life, perhaps even her whole life, she felt beautiful. She needed to pee. There was a toilet at the side of the barn, but when she got there, she found a line of people waiting to use it. She decided no one would mind if she used one of the bathrooms indoors. She was family enough, and after all, it was her party, kind of. So she headed for the porch. She came through the screen door, instinctively keeping her hand on it so it didn't slam. As she walked through the narrow, L-shaped boot room that led to the kitchen, she heard voices. Frank and Diane were having a row. "You've just had too much to drink," he said.
"Fuck you."
"It's none of our business, Diane."
"She's had her sights on him ever since she got here. Just take a look out there. She's like a bitch in heat."
"That's ridiculous."
"God, you men are so dumb."
There was an angry clatter of dishes. Grace had stopped in her tracks. Just as she decided she'd better go back to the barn and wait in line, she heard Frank's footsteps heading for the open door to the boot room. She knew she wouldn't have time to leave before he saw her. And if he caught her sneaking out, he'd know for sure she'd been eavesdropping. All she could do was head on in and bump into him as if she'd just come in. As Frank appeared in front of her in the doorway, he stopped and turned back to Diane.
Anyone would think you were jealous or something.
Oh, give me a break.
Well, you give him a break. He's a grown man, for Christ's sakes.
And she's a married woman with a kid, for Christ's sakes.
Frank turned and came into the boot room, shaking his head. Grace stepped toward him.
Hi,
she said brightly. He seemed a lot more than just startled, but he recovered instantly and beamed.
Hey, it's the belle of the ball. How you doing, sweetheart?
He put his hands on her shoulders.
Oh, I'm having a great time. Thanks for doing it and everything.
Grace, it's a real pleasure, believe me.
He gave her a little kiss on the forehead.
Is it okay if I use the bathroom in here? Just that there's a whole line.
Of course you can. You go right on in.
When she went through into the kitchen, there was no one there. She heard footsteps going upstairs. Sitting on the toilet, she wondered who it was they'd been arguing about, and got a first uneasy inkling that perhaps she knew. Annie got there before him and walked slowly around to the far side of the pool. The air smelled of chlorine. The strike of her shoes on the concrete floor echoed in the caverning darkness. She leaned against the whitewashed block wall and felt it soothing cool on her back. A sliver of light was spilling in from the barn, and she watched its reflection on the dead calm water of the pool. In the other world, outside, one country song ended and another, barely distinguishable, began. It seemed impossible that it was only last night that they'd stood there in the Creek House kitchen with no one to trouble them or keep them apart. She wished that she'd said then what she was going to tell him now. She hadn't trusted herself to find the right words. This morning, when she'd woken in his arms, she had been no less sure, even in that same bed which only a week ago she'd shared with her husband. Her only shame was that she felt none. Still, however, something had restrained her from telling him, and now she wondered if it was the fear of how he would react. It wasn't that she doubted for one moment his love. How could she? There was just something about him, some sad foreshadowing that was almost fatalistic. She had seen it today in his desperate intent that she should understand what he had done to Pilgrim. There was a brief flooding of light now at the end of the passageway to the barn. He stopped and scanned for her in the darkness. She stepped toward him, and at the sound he saw her and came to meet her. Annie ran the last few separating steps, as if suddenly he might be snatched away. She felt in his embrace the same shuddering release of what all evening she had tried herself to contain. Their breathing was as one, their mouths, their blood as if pulsed through interlacing veins by the same heart. When at last she could speak, she stood in the safety of his arms and told him that she was going to leave Robert. She spoke with such calm as she could muster, her cheek pressed to his chest, fearful perhaps of what she might see in his eyes were she to look. She said she knew how terrible the pain would be for all of them. Unlike the pain of losing Tom, however, it was a pain she could at least imagine. He listened in silence, holding her to him and stroking her face and hair. But when she had finished, still he didn't speak, and Annie felt the first cold finger of dread steal upon her. She lifted her head, daring at last to look at him, and saw he was too filled with emotion yet to speak. He looked away across the pool. Outside, the music thumped on. He looked back at her and gave a small shake of his head.
Oh, Annie.
What? Tell me.
You can't do that.
I can. I'll go back and tell him.
And Grace? You think you can tell Grace?
She peered at him, searching his eyes. Why was he doing this? She'd hoped for validation, and he'd proffered only doubt, thrusting at her immediately the one issue she dared not confront. And now Annie realized that in her deliberation she'd resorted to that old self-shielding habit of hers and rationalized it. Of course children were upset by these things, she'd told herself. It was inevitable. But if it was done in a civilized, sensitive way, there need be no lasting trauma. Neither parent was lost, only some obsolete geography. In theory, Annie knew this to be so. More than that, the divorces of several friends had proven it possible. Applied here and now, to them and Grace, it was of course nonsense. He said,
"After what she's suffered..."
"You think I don't know?"
"Of course you do. What I was going to say is that because of that, because you know, you'll never let yourself do this, even if now you think you can." She felt tears coming and knew she couldn't stop them.
"I have no choice." It was uttered in a small cry that echoed around the bare walls like a lament. He said,
"That's what you said about Pilgrim, but you were wrong."
"The only other choice is losing you."
He nodded.
"That's not a choice. Can't you see? Could you choose to lose me?"
"No," he said simply. "But I don't have to."
"Remember what you said about Pilgrim. You said he went to the brink and saw what was beyond and then chose to accept it."
"But if what you see there is pain and suffering, then only a fool would choose to accept it."
"But for us, it wouldn't be pain and suffering."
He shook his head.
Annie felt a rush of anger now. At him for uttering what she knew in her heart to be right, and at herself for the sobs now racking her body. "You don't want me," she said, and hated herself at once for her maudlin self-pity, then even more for the triumph she felt as his eyes welled with tears.
"Oh, Annie, you'll never know how much I want you."
She cried in his arms and lost all sense of time and place. She told him she couldn't live without him and saw no portent when he told her this was true for him but not for her. He said that in time she would assess these days not with regret but as some gift of nature that had left all their lives the better. When she could cry no more, she washed her face in the cool water of the pool, and he found a towel and helped her mop the mascara that had swum from her eyes. They waited, saying little more, while the blotching faded from her cheeks. Then, separately, when all seemed safe, they left.
Chapter 35. Annie felt like some mud-bound creature viewing the world from the bottom of a pond. It was the first time she had taken a sleeping pill in months. They were the ones airline pilots were rumored to use, which was supposed to make you confident about the pills, not doubtful of the pilots. It was true that in the past, when she'd taken them regularly, the after-effect seemed minimal. This morning they lay draped over her brain like a thick, dulling blanket she was powerless to shrug, though sufficiently translucent for her to remember why she'd taken the pill and be grateful that she had. Grace had come up to her soon after she and Tom came out of the barn and said bluntly that she wanted to go. She looked pale and troubled, but when Annie asked what was wrong, she said nothing was, she was just tired. She didn't seem to want to look her in the eyes. On the way back up to the Creek house, after they'd said their goodnights, Annie tried to chat about the party, but barely got a sentence in reply. She asked her again if she was all right, and Grace said she felt tired and a little sick.
"From the punch?"
"I don't know."
"How many glasses did you have?"
"I don't know. It's no big deal. Don't go on about it." She went straight up to bed, and when Annie went in to kiss her goodnight, she just muttered and stayed facing the wall, just as she used to when they first got here. Annie had gone straight to her sleeping pills. She reached for her watch now and had to force her muffled brain to focus on it. It was coming up to 8 o'clock. She remembered Frank, as they left last night, asking if they'd be coming to church this morning, and because it seemed appropriate, somehow punishingly final, she'd said yes. She hauled her reluctant body out of bed and along to the bathroom. Grace's door was slightly ajar. Annie decided to have a bath, then take in a glass of juice and wake her. She lay in the steaming water and tried to hold on to the last lacing of the sleeping pill. Through it she could feel already a cold geometry of pain configuring within her. "These are the shapes which now inhabit you," she told herself, "and to whose points and lines and angles you must become accustomed." She dressed and went to the kitchen to get Grace's juice. It was 8:30. Since her drowsiness had gone, she'd sought distraction in compiling mental lists of what needed to be done on this last day at the Double Divide. They had to pack, clean the house up, get the oil and tires checked, get some food and drink for the journey, settle up with the Bookers. As she came to the top of the stairs, she saw Grace's door hadn't moved. She tapped on it as she went in. The drapes were still closed, and she went across and drew them a little apart. It was a beautiful morning. Then she turned to the bed and saw it was empty. It was Joe who first discovered Pilgrim was missing, too. By then they'd searched every cobwebbed corner of every outbuilding on the ranch and found no trace of her. They split up and combed both sides of the creek, the twins hollering her name over and over and getting no reply but birdsong. Then Joe came yelling from down by the corrals, saying the horse was gone, and they all ran to the barn and found the saddle and bridle were gone, too.
"She'll be okay," Diane said. "She's just taking him for a ride somewhere."
Tom saw the fear in Annie's eyes. They both already knew it was something more. "She done anything like this before?" he said.
"Never."
"How was she when she went to bed?"
"Quiet. She said she felt a little sick. Something seemed to have upset her."
Annie looked so scared and frail, Tom wanted to hold her and comfort her, which would have looked only natural, but under Diane's gaze he didn't dare, and it was Frank who did it instead.
"Diane's right," Frank said. "She'll be okay."
Annie was still looking at Tom.
"Is Pilgrim safe enough for her to take out? She's only ridden him the once."
"He'll be all right," Tom said. It wasn't quite a lie. The real issue was whether Grace would be, and that depended on the state she was in. "I'll go with Frank and we'll see if we can find her."
Joe said he wanted to come too, but Tom told him no and sent him off with the twins to get Rimrock and their dad's horse ready while he and Frank went to change out of their church clothes. Tom was first out. Annie left Diane in the kitchen and followed him out over the porch to walk beside him to the barn. They only had the time it took to get there for the two of them to talk.
"I think Grace knows."
She spoke low, looking straight ahead. She was trying hard to keep control. Tom nodded gravely.
"I reckon so."
"I'm sorry."
"Don't ever be sorry, Annie. Ever." That was all they said because Frank came running up alongside, and the three of them walked in silence to the rail by the barn where Joe had the horses waiting.
"There's his tracks," Joe called.
He pointed at their clear outline in the dust. Pilgrim's shoes were different from those of every other shod horse on the ranch. There was no doubt the prints were his. Tom looked back just the once as he and Frank loped up the track toward the ford, but Annie was no longer there. Diane must have taken her inside. Only the kids still stood there watching. He gave them a wave. It wasn't till she found the matches in her pocket that Grace had the idea. She'd put them there after practicing the trick with her father at the airport while they waited for her flight to be called. She didn't know how long they'd ridden. The sun was high, so it must be some hours. She rode like a madwoman, consciously so, wholeheartedly, embracing madness and urging its return in Pilgrim. He'd sensed it and ran all morning, mouth afoam like a witch's nag. She felt that if she asked, he would even fly.
At first she'd had no plan, only a blind, destructive rage whose purpose and direction were not yet set and might be turned as easily on others as herself. Saddling him and shushing him in the gathering light of the corral, all she knew was that somehow she would punish them. She would make them sorry for what they'd done. Only when she reached the meadows and galloped and felt the cold air in her eyes did she start to cry. Then the tears took over and streamed, and she leaned forward over Pilgrim's ears and sobbed out loud. Now, as he stood drinking at the plateau pool, she felt her fury not lessen but distill. She slicked his sweating neck with her hand and saw again in her head those two guilty figures slinking one by one from the dark of the barn like dogs from a butcher's yard, thinking themselves unseen and unsuspected. And then her mother, with her makeup smeared by lust and still flushed from it, sitting there calmly at the wheel of the car and asking, as if butter wouldn't melt in her mouth, why she felt sick. And how could Tom do this? Her Tom! After all that caring and kindness, this was what he was really like. It had all been an act, a clever excuse for the two of them to hide behind. It was only a week, for God's sake, since he'd stood chatting and laughing with her dad. It was sick. Adults were sick. And everyone knew about it. Everyone. Diane had said so. Like a bitch in heat, she said. It was sick. It was all so sick. Grace looked over the plateau and beyond the ridge to where the first pass curved up like a scar into the mountains. Up there in the cabin where they'd all had such fun together on the cattle drive. Up there, that's where they'd done it. Soiling, spoiling the place. And then her mother lying like that, making out she was going there all alone to get her head together. Jesus! Well, she'd show them. She had the matches, and she'd show them. It would go up like paper. And they would find her charred black bones in the ashes, and then they'd feel sorry. Oh, yes, then they'd feel sorry. It was hard to know how much of a start she had on them. Tom knew a young guy on the reservation who could look at a track and tell you how old it was, near as damn it to the minute. Frank knew more than most about such things because of his hunting, a lot more than Tom, but still not enough to know how far ahead she was. What they could tell, however, was that she was riding the horse as hard as hell, and that if she kept it up, he'd soon be on his knees. It seemed pretty clear she was heading for the summer pastures, even before they found his hoof marks in the caked mud at the lip of the pool. From riding out with Joe, she knew the lower parts of the ranch pretty well, but the only time she'd been up here was on the cattle drive. If she wanted a bolt hole, the only place she'd know to head for was the cabin. That is, if she could remember the way when she got up into the passes. After 2 more weeks of summer, the place would look different. Even without the whirlwind that, judging by her progress, was going on in her head, she could easily get lost. Frank got down from his horse to take a closer look at the prints at the water's edge. He took off his hat and wiped the sweat from his face with his sleeve. Tom got down, too, and held the horses so they wouldn't spoil what evidence there was in the mud. What do you reckon? I don't know. It's kind of crusted already, but with the sun this hot, don't say too much. A half hour, maybe more. They let the horses drink and stood mopping their brows and looking out across the plateau. Frank said, "Thought we might get a sight of her from here." "Me too." Neither spoke for a while, just listened to the lap of the horses drinking. "Tom?" Tom turned to look at him and saw his brother shift and smile uneasily. "This is none of my business, but last night Diane... Well, you know she'd had a drink or two, and anyway, we was in the kitchen, and she was going on about how you and Annie were... Well, like I say, it's none of our business."
"It's okay. Go on."
"Well, she said one or two things, and anyway, Grace came in, and I'm not sure, but I think maybe she heard."
Tom nodded.
Frank asked him if that's what was going on here, and Tom told him he reckoned so.
They looked at each other, and some refraction of the pain in Tom's heart must have shown in his eyes. Frank said, "And pretty deep, huh?"
"About as deep as it gets."
They said no more, merely turned the horses from the water and set off across the plateau. So Grace knew, though how she knew, he didn't care. It was as he'd feared even before Annie had voiced the fear this morning. When they were leaving the party last night, he'd asked Grace if she'd had a good time, and she'd barely looked at him, just nodded and forced a token smile. What pain she must be in to have gone off like this, Tom thought. Pain of his making. And he took it inside him and embraced it in his own. At the crest of the ridge, they expected again to see her, but didn't. Her tracks, where they could see them, showed only a slight slackening of pace. Only once had she stopped, some 50 yards from the mouth of the pass. It looked as if she'd pulled Pilgrim up short, then walked him in a small circle, as if she was deciding or looking at something. Then she'd gone on again at a lope. Frank reined to a halt just where the land began to tilt sharply upward between the pines. He pointed at the ground for Tom to look.
"What do you make of that?"
There were not one set of hoof marks now, but many, though you could read Pilgrim's clearly among them because of his shoes. It was impossible to tell whose were the fresher.
"Must be some old Granola's Mustangs," Frank said.
"I guess so."
"I ain't never seen them this far up before, you?"
"Nope." They heard it as soon as they reached the bend about halfway up the pass, and they stopped to listen. There was a deep rumble, which at first Tom took to be a slide of rocks somewhere up in the trees. Then they heard a high-pitched clamor of screams and knew it was horses. They rode, fast but cautious, to the top of the pass, expecting any moment to come face to face with a stampede of mustangs. But aside from their upward tracks, there was no sign of them. It was hard to tell how many there were, maybe a dozen, Tom thought. At its highest point, the pass forked like a pair of tight pants into two diverging trails. To get to the high pastures, you had to go right. They stopped again and studied the ground. It was so churned with hooves in all directions, you could neither pick Pilgrims among them nor know which way he or any other horse had gone. The brothers split up, Tom taking the right and Frank the lower one left. About 20 yards up, Tom found Pilgrim's prints. But they were heading down, not up. A little farther up was another great churning of earth, and he was about to inspect it when he heard Frank call out. When he reined up next to him, Frank told him to listen. For a few moments, there was nothing. Then Tom heard it too, another frenzied call of horses.
"Where does this trail go?"
"I don't know. Ain't never been down there." Tom put his heels into Rimrock and launched him into a gallop. The trail went up, then down, then up again. It was winding and narrow, and the trees crowded so close on either side that they seemed to be whipping back the other way with a motion all their own. Here and there, one had fallen across the trail. Some they could duck and others jump. Rimrock never faltered, but measured his stride and cleared them all without brushing a branch. After maybe half a mile, the ground fell away again, then opened up under a steep, rock-strewn slope into which the trail had etched itself in a long, upward crescent. Below it, the ground fell sheer many hundreds of feet to a dark netherworld of pine and rock. The trail led to what appeared to be some vast and ancient quarry, carved into the limestone like a giant's cauldron that had cracked and spilled its contents down the mountain. From this place now, above the hammering of Rimrock's hooves, Tom heard again the scream of horses. Then he heard another, and knew with a sudden sickening that it was Grace. It wasn't until he pulled Rimrock up in the cauldron's gaping mouth that he could see into it. She was cowering at the back wall, trapped by a turmoil of shrieking mares. There were 7 or 8 of them, and some colts and foals, too, all running in circles and scaring each other more at every turn.
Their clamor echoed back at them from the walls, only to redouble their fear. And the more they ran, the more dust they churned, and the blindness only made them panic more. At the center, rearing and screaming and striking at each other with their hooves, were Pilgrim and the white stallion Tom had seen that day with Annie.
"Jesus Christ!"
Frank had arrived alongside. His horse balked at the sight, and he had to rein him hard and circle back beside Tom. Rimrock was troubled, but stood his ground. Grace hadn't seen them. Tom got down and handed Rimrock's reins to Frank.
"Stay here in case I need you, but you're going to have to make way pretty quick when they come," he said.
Frank nodded. Tom walked to his left with his back to the wall, never taking his eyes off the horses. They swirled in front of him like a crazed carousel. He could feel the bite of the dust in his throat. It was clouding so thick that beyond the mares, Pilgrim was only a dark blur against the rearing white shape of the stallion. Grace was now no more than 20 yards away. At last she saw him. Her face was very pale.
"You hurt?"
he yelled. Grace shook her head and tried to call back to him that she was okay. But her voice was too frail to carry through the din and the dust. She'd bruised her shoulder and twisted her ankle when she fell, but that was all. All that paralyzed her was fear, and fear more for Pilgrim than herself. She could see the bared pink of the stallion's gums above his teeth as he hacked away at Pilgrim's neck, where already there was the black glint of blood. Worst of all was the sound of their screams, a sound she'd heard only once before, on a snowy, sunlit morning in another place. She saw Tom now take off his hat and step out among the circling mares, waving it high in front of them. They skidded and shied away from him, colliding with those behind them. Now they'd all turned, and he moved in quickly behind them, driving them before him, away from Pilgrim and the stallion. One tried to break away to the right, but Tom dodged and headed it off. Through the dust cloud, Grace could see another man, Frank maybe, moving two horses clear of the gap. The mares, with the colts and foals at their tails, bolted past and made good their escape. Now Tom turned and worked his way around the wall again, giving space to the fighting horses, Grace supposed, so as not to drive them nearer to her. He stopped more or less where he'd been before and again called out, "Stay right there, Grace, you'll be okay." Then, without any sign of fear, he walked toward the fight. Grace could see his lips moving, but couldn't hear what he said over the horse's screams. Perhaps he was speaking to himself, or maybe not at all. He didn't stop until he was right up to them, and only then did they seem to register his presence. She saw him reach for Pilgrim's reins and take hold of them. Firmly, but without any violent jerking of his hand, he drew the horse down off his hind legs and turned him from the stallion. Then he slapped him hard on his rump and sent him away. Thus thwarted, the stallion turned his wrath on Tom. The picture of what followed would stay with Grace till the day she died, and never would she know for sure what happened. The horse wheeled in a tight circle, tossing his head and kicking up a spray of dust and rock shards with his hooves. With the other horses gone, his snorting fury had dominion of the air and seemed to grow with each resounding echo from the walls. For a moment he appeared not to know what to make of the man who stood undaunted before him. What was certain was that Tom could have walked away. 2 or 3 paces would have taken him out of the stallion's reach and clear of all danger. The horse, so Grace believed, would simply have let him be and gone where the others had led. Instead, Tom stepped toward him. The moment he moved, as he must have foreseen, the stallion reared up before him and screamed. And even now, Tom could have stepped aside. She had seen Pilgrim rear before him once and noted how deftly Tom could move to save himself. He knew where a horse's feet would fall, which muscle it would move, and why, before it even knew itself. Yet on this day he neither dodged, nor ducked, nor even flinched, and once more stepped in closer. The settling dust was still too thick for Grace to be sure, but she thought she now saw Tom open his arms a little
and in a gesture so minimal that she may have imagined it, show the horse the palms of his hands. It was as though he were offering something, and perhaps it was only what he'd always offered, the gift of kinship and peace. But although she would never from this day forth utter the thought to anyone, Grace had a sudden, vivid impression that it was otherwise, and that Tom, quite without fear or despair, was somehow this time offering himself. Then, with a terrible sound, sufficient alone to ratify the passing of his life, the hooves came down upon his head and struck him like a crumbled icon to the ground. The stallion reared again, but not so high, and only now to find some safer surface for his feet than the man's body. He seemed for a moment fazed by such prompt capitulation, and pawed the dust uncertainly around Tom's head. Then, tossing his mane, he cried out one last time, then swerved toward the gap and was gone. Part 5. Chapter 36. Spring came late to Chatham the following year. One night in the closing days of April there fell a full foot of snow. It was of that heavy, languid kind and gone within the day, but Annie feared it might have withered the buds already forming on Robert's 6 small cherry trees. When, however, in May the world at last warmed, they seemed to reassert themselves, and the blossom when it came was full and unblemished. Now the show was past its best. The pink of the petals faded and delicately edged in brown. With each stir of the breeze, another flurry would dislodge, littering the grass in wide circumference. Those that fell unbidden were mostly lost among the longer grass that grew around the roots. Some few, however, found a final brief reprieve on the white gauze netting of a cradle, which since the weather had grown mild stood daily in the dappled shade. The cradle was old and made of woven wicker. It had been handed down by an aunt of Robert's when Grace was born, and prior to her had sheltered the cranial formation of several more or less distinguished lawyers. The netting across which Annie's shadow now loomed was new. She had noticed how the child liked to watch the petals settle on it, and she left those already there untouched. She looked in and saw he was sleeping. It was too early to tell whose looks he had. His skin was fair and his hair a light brown, though in the sun it seemed to have a reddish tinge that was surely Annie's. From the day of his birth, now almost 3 months past, his eyes were never anything but blue. Annie's doctor had told her she should sue. The coil had only been in 4 years, a year less than its recommended life. When he examined it, the copper was worn right through. The manufacturers would be sure to settle, he said, for fear of bad publicity. Annie had simply laughed, and the sensation was so alien it had shocked her. No, she said, she didn't want to sue, and neither, despite poor precedent and all his eloquent listing of the risks, did she want a termination. Were it not for the steady configuration in her womb, Annie doubted whether any of them, she or Robert or Grace, would have survived. It could, or should perhaps, have made things worse, become a bitter focus for their several sorrows. Instead, after the shock of its discovery, her pregnancy had, by slow degree, brought healing and a kind of clarifying calm. Annie now felt a welling pressure in her breasts and for a moment thought of waking him to feed. He was so very different from Grace.
She had rapidly grown restless at the breast, as if it couldn't meet her needs, and by this age she was already on bottles. This one just latched on and drank as if he'd done it all before. When he'd had his fill, he simply fell asleep. She looked at her watch. It was nearly 4. In an hour, Robert and Grace would be setting off from the city. Annie briefly considered going back inside to do a little more work, but decided against it. She'd had a good day, and the piece she was working on, though in style and content quite unlike anything she'd ever written, was going well. She decided instead to walk up past the pond to the field and have a look at the horses. When she got back, the baby would most likely be awake. They'd buried Tom Booker beside his father. Annie knew this from Frank. He'd written her a letter. It was sent to Chatham and arrived on a Wednesday morning in late July when she was all alone and had just found out she was pregnant. The intention, Frank said, had been to keep the funeral small, pretty much only for family. But on the day, about 300 people turned up, some from as far afield as Charleston and Santa Fe. There was room for only a few in the church, so they'd open wide the doors and windows, and everyone else stood outside in the sunshine. Frank said he thought Annie would like to know this. The main purpose of his writing, he went on to say, was that on the day before he died, Tom had apparently told Joe that he wanted to give Grace a present. The two of them had come up with the idea that she should have Bronte's foal. Frank wanted to know how Annie felt about it. If she thought it was a good idea, they'd ship him over in Annie's trailer along with Pilgrim. It was Robert's idea to build the stable. Annie could see it now as she walked up toward the field, framed at the end of the long avenue of hazel that curved up from the pond. The building stood stark and new against a steep bank of fresh-leafed poplar and birch. It still surprised Annie every time she saw it. Its wood had barely weathered, nor that of the new gate and fence abutting. The different greens of the trees and of the grass in the field were so vivid and new and intense, they seemed almost to hum. Both horses lifted their heads at her approach, then went calmly back to their grazing. Bronte's foal was now a boisterous yearling, who in public was treated by Pilgrim with a kind of lofty disdain. It was mostly an act. Many times now Annie had caught them playing. She folded her arms on the bar of the gate and leaned her chin to watch. Grace worked with the colt every weekend. Watching her, it was so clear to Annie how much the girl had learned from Tom. You could see it in her movements, even in the way she talked to the horse. She never pushed too hard, just helped him find himself. He was coming on well. Already you could see in him that same soft feel that all the horses had at the Double Divide. Grace had named him Gully, but had first asked Annie if she thought Judith's mom and dad would mind. Annie said she was sure they wouldn't. She found it hard to think of Grace nowadays without a feeling of reverence and wonder. The girl, now nearly 15, was a constantly revealing miracle. The week that followed Tom's death was still a blur, and it was probably best for both of them that it remained so. They'd left as soon as Grace was fit to travel and flown back to New York. For days, the girl was almost catatonic. It was the sight of the horses that August morning which seemed to bring about the change. It unlocked a sluice gate in her, and for 2 weeks she wept and poured forth her agony. It might have swept them all away. But in the flooded calm of its aftermath, Grace seemed to take stock and decide, like Pilgrim, to survive. In that moment, Grace became an adult. But sometimes now, when she didn't know she was being watched, you could catch a glimpse in her eyes of something that was more than merely adult. Twice gone to hell, and twice returned.
She had seen what she had seen, and from it gleaned some sad and stilling wisdom that was as old as time itself. In the fall, Grace went back to school, and the welcome she got there from her friends was worth 1,000 sessions with her new therapist, whom nonetheless, even now, she still visited every week. When, at last, with great trepidation, Annie had told her about the baby, Grace was overjoyed. She had never once to this day asked who the father was. Neither had Robert. No test had established the fact, nor had he sought one. It seemed to Annie that he preferred the possibility of the child being his to the certainty that it wasn't. Annie had told him everything. And just as guilts of variant cause and intricacy were etched forever in her own and Grace's hearts, so too was the hurt she had wrought in his. For Grace's sake, they had adjourned all decision on what future, if any, their marriage might have. Annie stayed in Chatham, Robert in New York. Grace commuted between them, like some healing shuttle, restoring strand by strand the torn fabric of their lives. Once school had started, she came up to Chatham every weekend, usually by train. Sometimes, however, Robert would drive her. At first he would drop her off, kiss her goodbye, and, after a few formal words with Annie, drive all the way back to the city. One rain-soaked Friday night in late October, Grace prevailed on him to stay over. The three of them ate supper together. With Grace, he was as funny and loving as ever. With Annie, he was reserved, never less and never more than courteous. He slept in the guest room and left early the following morning. This was to become their unacknowledged Friday routine. And though on principle he had never yet stayed more than the one night, his departure the next day had gradually got later. On the Saturday before Thanksgiving, the three of them had gone for breakfast at the bakery. It was the first time they had been there as a family since the accident. Outside, they bumped into Harry Logan. He made a big fuss of Grace and made her blush by telling her how grown up and gorgeous she looked. It was true. He asked if he could stop by and say hi to Pilgrim sometime, and they said sure he could. As far as Annie knew, no one in Chatham had any idea what had happened in Montana, other than that their horse had gotten better. Harry looked at Annie's protruding belly and shook his head and smiled. "You guys," he said, "just the sight of you, all four of you, makes me feel so good. I'm really, really happy for you." There was much marveling at how, after so many miscarriages, Annie had managed this time to go full term without trouble. The obstetrician said strange things often happened with elderly pregnancies. Annie said thanks very much. The baby was born in early March by planned cesarean. They asked her if she wanted to have an epidural and watch, and she said absolutely not. She wanted every kind of dope they had. She woke, as once she had before, to find the baby on the pillow beside her. Robert and Grace were there too, and the three of them all wept and laughed together. They named him Matthew, after Annie's father. On the breeze now, Annie could hear the baby crying. When she turned away from the gate and started to walk back down toward the cherry trees, the horses didn't lift their heads. She would feed him, then take him inside and change him. Then she'd sit him in the corner of the kitchen so he could watch her with those clear blue eyes while she got the supper ready. Maybe she could persuade Robert to stay the whole weekend this time. As she came past the pond, some wild ducks took off, their wings clattering the water. There was only one other thing Frank mentioned in the letter he had sent her last summer. Sorting out Tom's room, he said he'd come across an envelope on the table. It had Annie's name on it, and so he now enclosed it. Annie looked at it a long time before she opened it.
She thought how strange it was that never till now had she seen Tom's handwriting. Inside, folded in a sheet of plain white paper, was the loop of cord he'd taken back from her on that last night they spent together in the Creek House. On the paper, all he'd written was, "In case you forget."
The End. You've been listening to The Horse Whisperer by Nicholas Evans, narrated by Frank Muller. In the week following publication of The Horse Whisperer, Nicholas Evans paid a visit to the New York studios of Recorded Books to talk for a while about the writing of the novel. Nicholas Evans.
I've been working for the last 10 years as a writer of films and a producer of those films. And my first incarnation was really as a journalist for a newspaper, and then I went on to work as a reporter and then a producer in television documentaries and current affairs. That's when I first really got to know the States. I covered American politics for a British TV current affairs show. And in 1976, I followed the presidential campaign and went to primaries in little Midwestern towns that, you know, I'd never have got to see as a tourist. I'd always had this romantic notion about the American West and wanted to set up. It was no more than an intention, actually, a couple of years ago, to write a big contemporary love story set in the American West. I mean, I've always been a sucker for it, really. As a kid, I used to watch Westerns the whole time and played cowboys and Indians for about, well, actually, I'd probably be embarrassed to tell you how long I played it, but... And long before I came to America, you know, I felt I knew a lot about the American West just by reading books and... You know, Zane Grey and Jack London was a slightly different kind of thing, but I read a lot of Western things, and of course saw a lot of movies. And you used to export your TV programs to us in vast numbers. So Cheyenne and Wagon Train and Rawhide and all of these kinds of things I used to just live for, really. And but I'd never, in fact, been to Montana. I knew California pretty well. This was, you know, a couple of years ago when I first heard about horse whisperers. And when I came to research it in the spring of last year, I've traveled widely around the West and went down to New Mexico, where there was one horse guy who I wanted to see. And then I went up into Northern California and spent time with another guy there, then up to Wyoming, and then eventually in Montana, where I thought originally I was going to set the story in near Billings, in the Pryor Mountains, around the Bighorn Canyon, which was the first place I went to, and I thought it was stunning. And then I swung west, and because I thought I ought to see some more of the state, and I went to Missoula, and when I was in Missoula, met some people who said... when I told them about the story, they said, "Have you thought about the Rocky Mountain Front?" And I said I hadn't, and I didn't know really what it was. And they said, "Well, you should go and have a look." And they gave me the address and an introduction to a rancher who lived on the Rocky Mountain Front. So I drove up and over the divide and came down from Browning down to Dupuyer, just north of Shoto. And I was just knocked out by the place. And as soon as I saw it, I knew this is where the book had to be set. I mean, it really is a wondrous place. It's where the Great Plains, the High Plains, which stretch for as far as the eye can see, and for all you know, to the end of the world, actually, to the east. And then they run smack into this sheer wall of limestone. I mean, this ancient wall of limestone. And it is just so remote and daunting and beautiful and majestic that they were right. That's where the book had to be set. I mean, it starts off, of course, in on the East Coast in Chatham, New York, and I knew I knew that well because some friends of mine who live in New York City have a house up there as well, and I'd been to stay with them many times. I'm the godfather to their daughter, and we've spent many, of all seasons, much time up there together. So when I first came over to the States in the spring of last year to research it, I first of all went to Chatham and asked lots of specific questions there. I mean, that's where the accident at the beginning of the book is set, of course, and I needed to find out about rescue services and where, if you were caught in an accident, where you might get taken and what the hospital would do and how many people were in the helicopter and all these kinds of detailed questions. And then I went over to the West and spent a lot of time with these horse people. I'd never heard of horse whisperers until 2 years ago, and although as a kid I rode and we never owned horses, but there were farms nearby where we always had access to the horses. And I was staying with a friend of mine down on Dartmoor in the southwest of England, a place where there are wild horses. And he introduced me to a blacksmith who works down there. And this guy told me of having seen a horse whisperer at work some 10 years before. And I'd never heard the term. So I asked him about it. My ears pricked up and I was just fascinated in it. And he told me of what he'd seen, which was this little gypsy guy who was known as the local whisperer, being called down to sort out a woman's horse that had gone demented. It was a calm, loving creature until it had been sent away to stay somewhere else and had come back in a complete frenzy, and no one could go near it. And this gypsy guy listened to what had happened and walked into the field, and within the course of an afternoon had transformed this animal back to what it had always been. I mean, by the end of the day, it was calm and loving and fine again. You know, his head was cleared. And something about this story just touched me greatly. It's hard to know why something moves you at any time in your life, but maybe I was just sort of open to it at that time. I've always had a thing about animals and loved animals. But this idea that you could reach across the boundaries of a species and understand and help sort out a problem in another species just moved me greatly. So I set about researching it and found out, of course, that this thing goes back centuries. I mean, probably for as long as there have been men and horses in the same place, there have been people who had this gift of healing horses. I did a lot of reading about ancient man and how they treated horses, and you know, it's hard to find that kind of stuff out, but there are ascertainable things like, you know, huge piles of bones being found at the foot of cliffs, and this is taken as evidence, and there are cave paintings to support this too, that man used to hunt horses for their meat and they would drive them off cliffs. You know, they would use their very characteristic of flight to kill them. And then somebody got smart and realized that actually these horses you could use to kill other creatures. So this uneasy alliance, and it's always been a kind of uneasy alliance, maybe because it was built upon this initial slaughter, gradually came about. And certainly in the Middle Ages, in medieval times in England and all over Europe, there start to be accounts of people who were able to transform horses. And often, you know, they were seen as witches. The whole thing was surrounded with magic and folklore, and there are accounts of horse whisperers being burned at the stake as witches. I mean, there's some fascinating stuff about it. Horse brasses, for example, that, you know, working horses have on their heads, are the origin of those is something shiny to deflect the evil eye so that a witch won't possess the soul of a horse or the devil won't come into the horse. And all kinds of rituals that I found out about. There were people called toad men who would catch a toad or a frog and hang it out to dry on a thorn bush. I kill it and hang it out to dry, and then take the bones, the skeleton, and float the skeleton in a stream by the light of a full moon, and one bone, which is the shape of the frog, it's called the frog in the horse's hoof, the bottom of the hoof, will supposedly float back upstream, and then the toad man would take this bone and crush it and make a powder of it and feed it to the horse, and the horse would cease to be demented and be calm again. I mean, I've never tried this. Maybe I should, but there's so much interesting stuff. You know, what I hadn't realized, I suppose, was that how profound a place in American culture and the American psyche, in a way, the horse has. And actually, not just in American culture. Certainly in the Far East, the horse has a similar sort of place that it's and is wrapped up with magic. And all over the world, you'll find horses related with this sort of magical thing. Maybe because people see in horses some curious possession of a secret that maybe we don't have access to. But it never occurred to me that this should be a film, curiously. I mean, I've never wanted to write a novel until I heard this story, but it seemed to me to have this whole business of horse whispering had such resonance. It had such a huge kind of metaphorical significance that it would be to throw it away completely, to make a screenplay out of it. Screenplays are such constricting things, you know, you can't open them up and get into the characters and spread yourself in a way that you can in a novel. So, no, I want it. It always seemed to me that this was a novel, and it took what now seems an astonishingly long time. I mean, a couple of months before I realized that this intention I'd had to write a love story set in the American West and this thing about horse whisperers were in fact the same story, that they slotted into each other like a hand into a glove. And as soon as that happened, I just couldn't wait to get out here to research it. And that's what I did in the spring of last year. It's hard because of all the fuss around the horse whisperer to realize, well, for some people to realize that it was never a kind of money-making exercise. It was, you know, one or two people thought, oh, well, he must have sat down and written the bestseller. And God, I should have been so lucky. I'd have done it 20 years ago if I'd known how. In fact, this time last year, if I'd tried to sit down and write a bestseller, I think I'd have written something entirely different, you know, maybe a big high-finance action, you know, Die Hard in Wall Street or, you know, something like that. Who'd have, in their right mind, thought that a story based around a horse would capture people's imagination so much? So, no, I've never, ever been able to write from anything other than passion and have often turned things down because I couldn't connect with them. You know, just doing something for money didn't seem to me to be personally, that's the way I could... I just couldn't make the thing work for that reason. This story, right from the start, moved me immensely, or the phenomenon of horse whispering moved me enormously. And I sort of believed that if I could write it properly, then it would move other people. I had doubts about whether I could pull it off. And in fact, I'd written half of the novel. I came back from America and sat down and wrote what turns out to be half of it. And then I stopped because I really wondered whether it was worth going on with. And I showed it to a friend who was an agent, not at the time my agent, he is now. And he read it. And had he said it wasn't worth continuing with, I wouldn't have done. I'd have put it away in a bottom drawer or thrown it away or something. And it's quite scary to think about that. But he said it was okay. And if we wanted to, and I needed to make a little money. I hadn't made any money for a couple of years because I'd had a film fall through and the bank was getting a bit edgy with me. So he said we could try sending it out to some British publishers and see if we could get what we thought would be a modest advance to, so I could finish the book. And so that's what we did. And then in this astonishing sort of flurry of activity, other publishers got hold of it. We don't know even to this day how a lot of them got hold of it, but soon enough, all over the world, people were asking if they could have it and making these ludicrously high offers for it, including the film rights. And so I then sat down and finished the book, knowing that, you know, it was worth going on with. I mean, not just from a financial point of view, but I just had this great vote of confidence in it.
Nicholas Evans, discussing the creation of The Horse Whisperer. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Beach Music by Pat Conroy, also narrated by Frank Muller. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more in the Recorded Books catalog. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the telephone number found on the back of the book. You can order with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune in to narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.